Hello and welcome to Healthy Bloomington with Dr. Andry. I am Dr. Matt Andry, a family physician here in Bloomington, Indiana. And on this program, we talk about issues of health and medicine and ways to help you get more out of your interaction with your healthcare providers. And with me today is a very good friend of mine and an absolute expert in multiple fields of health-related topics. And he is the host of Superhuman Radio, and it's Carl Lenore. Carl, welcome and thank you.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, we've been, I forget exactly how long it's been since we met, but the first conversation we had, it felt like I found a long-lost brother.
Yeah, I felt the same way.
And the passion that we have for trying to help people get more control of their health, to take health care back from the hands of those who had wrested it from us, it was instantly easy to tell. And just a curious mind, and that to me is maybe the most important factor when it comes to, you know, what do you really need to get healthier? I think that's the best place to start. Have a curious mind and don't overlook any topic just because it sounds wrong to you. What the heck do you know? Because I know I don't know everything.
Right. And I think that people need to start practicing critical thinking. A lot of times physicians will tell patients something and it just doesn't fit right. Doesn't feel right to the patient. They just get a visceral sensation. But they've been taught to ignore that sensation and always trust the physician. Mm-hmm. And, you know, physicians are human beings. They wake up in the morning on the good side and the bad side of the bed. They get a good night's sleep. They don't get a good night's sleep. They missed that particular anatomy physiology class. They didn't ask a question on the test that exposed that. And then they end up in practice. And the key word here is practice. We're practicing medicine means, well, it's not a science yet. We're still working the details out.
Yes.
And you, the patient, are really in some way, you know, the test rabbit or the test mouse. And so a lot of people need to start applying critical thinking. When your doctor tells you something and it doesn't fit right, it doesn't feel right, you need a follow-up question.
That's
Most
right.
People don't want to ask that question because they're afraid to hurt their doctor's feelings. If you ask your doctor a question and your doctor becomes indignant, that's usually a sign you need to find another doctor.
I think that's right. I mean, my colleagues are, they're all over the board on their comfort level with questions. I certainly know many who relish them and find them as an opportunity to learn. And that's kind of the way I think about it. I love it when somebody asks me about something I don't know. I get excited. I'm like, man, there's something else. There's something new, you know, and that intellectual curiosity kind of overrides any fear I have about seeing as incompetent. Because we're all competent and we're all incompetent. I mean, that just depends on the day and what we're talking about. But,
yeah.
And we're all dying. But we're here to try to get more out of life and to get our bodies and minds to serve what our purpose is here. And, you know, a big part of your purpose the last several years has been...
10 years. November, it'll be 10 years. Can you believe that?
10 years. Wow.
Yeah.
Did you think it would even stay that long when you started it?
I you know what? I put my head down and I just did the work. And now behind me, I have a body of work that is over a couple thousand shows, 2 hours each. I mean, it's just a big monster.
And multiple millions of people that have heard these programs and benefited from it and taken the information and applied them in their lives. And people who are listening, go check it out, superhumanradio.com. You'll find an archive of shows there about various topics that, in all honesty, they're going to be a lot more advanced than you're going to get from going to your typical doctor's office. But they can bring up things that you should be talking about with your healthcare provider. You know, and times are changing. I mean, I have an easier time having these discussions with other doctors than I used to. In the old days, no one ever questioned the authority of a physician. But I think people are more comfortable now in an age when there is internet medicine, when there is a wealth of information out there. People are better educated and they're more informed.
Yes.
And that's a big part of what I'm doing this program for and you do yours for. But that issue of critical thinking, I absolutely agree with, and really, you know, you got to be a salesman when you're going and talking to a healthcare provider, and that may be an odd way for people to think, but you want to sell that physician on what you think your plan is when you go in, if you have one, and I think it's good to go in with one, and I think far too often we've just abrogated our our rights and our expectations about what health should be to a physician and said, okay, doctor, just heal me. Well, you just made yourself at the mercy of whether they do, of its being right or wrong, and they're at the mercy of what their group practice does, and their group's at the mercy of what the FDA says they can do. And if you're going to live and die by what the FDA says, you're already dead.
Yeah, that's the truth. And, you know, if you go into your physician with a plan, and quite often, thanks, as you pointed out, thanks to the internet, you quite often can be better apprised of breaking research in the area of your particular interest,
yes,
your health, than your physician.
Yes.
And if you go in with this notion that, you know, I've done a lot of good research, and for those out there who don't know where to start on research, Google for smart people is called PubMed, PubMed.com. that's Google for smart people. You can find every study ever published back to the 60s there, and you can,
yep,
search for the answers for your questions there. You'll have to get a medical dictionary, and you'll step up your intelligence. You'll end up being the smartest person in your family in a couple days. But if you walk into your physician and say, hey, what about this? One of two things will happen. Either your physician will immediately discount what you're bringing to the forefront and may even bristle a little bit, because some physicians feel threatened by this. Or your physician will say, let me look it over and get back to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a better answer, because they're not going to know everything. It's impossible for a physician. We want our physicians to be brilliant, and they are brilliant. But
yes,
it's impossible to know everything about everything.
Right, right. And, you know, if there is a sort of, you know, what would I say that my medical experience has brought me? More than it's brought information, and I pride myself a little bit on being open to new information and taking it in and trying to integrate it. But what it is perspective. You know, the ability to prioritize, because people will hear about a new treatment for this, that, or the other, but it can be very difficult to know where to position that in a treatment regimen. For example, if somebody can have Crohn's disease, and, you know, if you've got a mild case that's been under control for a while, then yes, going after elimination diets and probiotics as a way to treat it may be just the thing. But man, if your gut is bleeding out and you've lost 40 pounds and you can't absorb any food, it's time to talk Humira.
those treatment protocols should be rescue mechanisms, right?
Yes.
You break your leg, your physician puts on a cast. He doesn't say you're going to wear this cast for the rest of your life. He says you're going to wear this cast until the initial healing is done, and you can start bare weight on your own and move it, and the cast comes off.
Right.
And that's how things like Humira and, quite frankly, cholesterol meds and blood pressure meds should be treated as last resort. Rescue the patient. Get them propped up into a position where now we can start moving towards things that will eliminate the problem instead of just masking the symptom.
That's right. You know, I think your movement in health information and media has echoed mine a little bit in that, or vice versa, in that, you know, I've moved more toward more natural means for everything, nutrition, and you even started that way largely. But, you know, when we like take hormones, for example. When I first learned about hormones, man, testosterone was the answer to everything.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And then I've over time, I tend to use lower doses. I tend to use different intervals for different patients. I tend to use multiple agents for specific patients because their systems are just so different. But I've also found that you and I both have a bad habit, and that is we keep asking why. You know, and if your T is low, we don't go, well, okay, it's low. How did it end up that way? Why am I not making it? Even if
right.
I don't know the answer, there is some answer.
Right.
And having a curious mind about that, and what answers that does give you, will give you clues to other things besides testosterone. You on your show, I mean, you've covered testosterone at great length.
Yes.
And you have had
especially
a lot of
especially in light of the witch hunt that's going on now.
Yes, and you're aware, I'm presuming, of the in about 2 weeks, we're going to have a label change for all of the topical testosterones.
Yes, it's going to have a black box warning on it.
Yeah, I don't think this one's going to be black box, but it is going to have dedicated area for cardiovascular risk. They also took out an indication. All these medicines used to be indicated for what they called idiopathic hypogonadism. For whatever the reason, if your testosterone was low, that it was okay to use this. They've taken out that language. And I was really frustrated. I was talking with a couple of the big-time researchers who do a lot of work with these companies, and they were saying that all I could tell it was like a negotiated piece on the FDA panel between those people who just think no one should get testosterone and those people who think everyone should get testosterone. And they just found a happy medium where their only goal seems to be to get about a third fewer scripts written. And they don't seem to care. I mean, because they are still, in my mind, 10 years behind in understanding the why, the how, and in what way you should give these hormones. The starting dose of our topicals is by a factor of 4 or 5 too big. When we're 15, 16, 17, 18 years old and up to 20 when our max testosterone is made, we're making about 15 milligrams a day.
Right.
But if you're using a topical, it's so fat soluble, it doesn't like to go to the blood. It will travel through lymph vessels, it'll travel through tissue, but it takes a dose of 50 milligrams to get the average person's level up to what they call therapeutic. But they act like when you put it on, it doesn't go anywhere else, and that's crazy. And these same people will kind of vilify somebody who's taking, injectable testosterone because they say the doses are too big, when the daily dose is actually quite a bit smaller than the topicals.
Yeah.
So it's no wonder the topicals are having CV risk if we're overdosing them, wouldn't you say?
But we have to be clear about something. I have to go back to even further than that. The two studies that brought cardiovascular risk to the forefront with testosterone were very, very, very flawed studies.
Yes, okay? Yes, they were.
The first one, which I believe, and I haven't talked about this in a year, because it was the end of 2013, I think, that the first one launched out.
Yes.
It was a two-year study on men who had already been angiopathized.
Diagnosed, yep.
So that means that they've already got heart problems. You don't go to your doctor and he goes, and we're going to cath you today and take a look at your heart. No, you have a problem.
You had an MI.
And you've arrived at the hospital, you're clutching your chest, and they go, we got to go in there and see what's going on. So you've already had an angio catheter and maybe even a plasty where they put a balloon in and a stent or whatever. And so this is a sick population of men.
Yes.
And then they prescribe them testosterone after the fact. Now, think about this. First of all, 40% of the men on the prescription only had 2 prescriptions filled over the two-year period. Now, think about that. They're supposed to be getting this prescription filled either every month or every other month. So those guys weren't even on testosterone. In fact,
yep.
That group could be called
placebo.
If you don't take your testosterone, you're going to have a heart attack.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
Okay. The balance of the men had an average of 6 prescriptions filled over the two-year period. So none of these guys were actually on testosterone. If you prescribe testosterone for me, Matt, but I don't take it, is it working for me? Of course not.
Nope.
Okay? So the fact that they blame testosterone for these cardiovascular events was laughable. But then the next study that came out, once again, on a sick population of men who were taking their testosterone, no one asked this question, Matt. Now, I've been on testosterone since 2007.
Mm-hmm.
When a man is going through andropause, it's a very, very slow process. In fact, the analogy I use on my show is, by the time I was 45 years old, it's like living in a warehouse that has 100 light bulbs. Imagine you living in the Costco warehouse. It's got 100 light bulbs. Every year, just one bulb goes out.
Mm-hmm.
So the transition from one year to the other is not even noticeable. But then one afternoon, when you're 50 years old, somebody comes in and puts 50 new light bulbs in the 50 dead ones, and you look up at the ceiling and you go, oh my God, is this how bright it used to be in here? That's the analogy I give when men get on testosterone after going through andropause. The changes are so subtle, so slow, but they're cumulative and they mount. And by the time the guy gets on testosterone, guess what he wants to do? I'm going to the gym.
Yep.
I want to have sex more often.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, he has a mild heart attack. So was it the testosterone
it was
that
the
caused
activity.
The heart attack? Or the activity that he feels that he wants to engage in because he feels like he's alive again?
That's a very good point. And we know, I mean, it was very disingenuous to me, the way they act like, oh my God, you mean testosterone can increase the risk? Well, it makes your blood thicker, which we're going to talk about that more here in a bit. It raises your estrogen, and if you don't manage that well, you can raise your risk of you raise your clotting factors produced in the liver.
That's right.
If you get your neck thicker and you have apnea and don't deal with it, then your risk of oxygen depletion at night goes up. That's hard on the heart. And you can affect lipids, and you can affect blood pressure. And you don't think it could impact cardiovascular risk? Come on.
Right.
It just needs to be done with somebody who's helping you manage those. And really, whether they are or not, you need to manage those yourself.
Yes, because all of those symptoms occur quite often in aging men anyway who
yes.
don't take care of themselves. And just real quick, not to segue too far, but there's some really good research that shows that a sex hormone binding globulin that is actually linking itself to obstructive sleep apnea, and that goes up, obviously, when your testosterone goes up as well.
Absolutely. You know, and it's so much more complex than we pretend, but to say that the testosterone is the factor is, again, like you said at one time, it's blaming the fire trucks for the fires.
Exactly. If you look at things from an epidemiological standpoint, you would have to say that fire trucks cause fires because they're the one thing that is consistently always at the site of a fire. And that's not how science works.
No.
Science doesn't work that way.
No. And bad science works very much not that way. But these guys, you know, I want to talk for just a moment about the difference between topical and injectable testosterone. You've always used injectable. And I don't have...
Oh, no, that's not true. I have used topical a long time ago when I was a powerlifting athlete,
mm-hmm.
and I was too afraid to inject. Now, this was not testosterone mm-hmm. that I was prescribed. I'm being very honest about that, but through the honesty comes learning. Okay?
Right.
I don't want people to judge me about that. Okay.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no biggie. But, I mean, I don't have a problem per se with topical, but... what I have a problem with is people not understanding physiology and doctors acting like it doesn't matter. You know, when you make this, when you make testosterone in the testes, it is released directly into the bloodstream. It doesn't have to go through multiple layers of tissue before it gets to a place that it can travel. So it's no wonder that it takes, you know, a bigger dose. And these tissues that are getting it, it's not that we think testosterone in and of itself is harmful, but it is going to move things. It is going to have effects and to act like... that's somehow superior because a big drug company made it is just flawed thinking. You know, no company has a market on injectable because it's too cheap.
Yes.
Anybody can use it. Anybody can make it. So there's no real market for a pharmaceutical to come in and charge 10 times as much, which is what it would take for them to get to do it. So again, people have to, you know, you and I both know that the more knowledge we put in people's hands, you know, it makes them dangerous to the system,
But it makes them good for themselves. The other problem with injectable testosterone is convenience. So most people will not inject themselves because you have to. This is an intramuscular injection. Although 5 or 6 years ago, I started talking about subcutaneous
yes.
injections of oils, and now
many
aging doctors all of a sudden. I even had a guy on my show challenge me, saying it was a bad idea. Because more of it would aromatize, and that's come to be false.
Mm-hmm.
And more men now can use sub-Q injections. Usually a half a milliliter leaves a little tiny bump that's virtually not even visible, and it dissipates over the course of 5 or 6 days, and it makes it easier for the guy who says, look, I don't want to have to stick this into a muscle and aspirate and worry if I'm going to hit a vein. That scares me. I'm not going to do it. And his doctor's going to say, well, look, I can't have you come in here twice a week because that's really the best protocol is to inject twice a week to keep blood levels very stable. He says, I'll have you come here every other week, and he gives him this big bolus dose. He has this huge spike. He feels fantastic. And then by the second week, he feels like a withered old woman again.
Yep.
That doesn't work either.
Right. And people can vary greatly on how much they burn through it, in essence. And that depends on your...
Yeah, because if you're a hard-training athlete, you're going to use that testosterone up quickly.
You sure are. And if you have a ramped-up liver because, let's say you, alcohol impacts the way the liver takes care of these things. Other drugs and other medicines do. And you can't have a one-size-fits-all treatment. You have to tailor this to where somebody's at. You have to, I get a lot of people, and you were actually the first person to tell me this before I ever, I detected it clinically, but I didn't know what to do with it, that guys will burn through, a third of them will burn through half of their medicine in 3 days.
Yeah.
And that's not listed on the product insert of any of the products that me or any other clinicians are given. Which, again, that's where clinical experience and, you know, people talking to each other, this is where at least the root of good information comes from. And that's what science should be based on. It's based on observations, not based on a result you want to get. And so you do the study to do it. And that's what all the testosterone studies struck me as. It seemed like they wanted a certain answer and they waited till they got it.
Well, and quite frankly, that's not being driven from the people or the patient side. That's being driven from the medical orthodoxy side, because there are things that they want to do and think they don't want to be bothered doing. And so quite often, the options available to the patient are not necessarily the best options for the patient, but the most convenient options for medicine.
Yep, that's right. And that's part of being a good consumer, is just realizing that those are the goals. And that doesn't mean your physician is part and parcel of that or is thinking necessarily that way. But that physician is going to be subject to the same quality of information that comes in, be that good or bad.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Well, Carl, we're going to we're going to wrap this show up, but I'd love to have you back. And I want to talk about specifically some health topics that you've been interested in of late, if you're willing to. And just we'll give people some good specific information about how our bone marrow works and how our body takes care of toxin elimination and nutrient delivery.
Absolutely. I love talking about this stuff, because if we just inspire one person out there to become the steward of their own health, then it's all worthwhile.
Amen. Amen. Thank you. And once again, how would people who are interested in the show, where should they go, Carl?
Superhumanradio.com. There's blog posts, articles, radio shows. I mean, it's just a single stop for everything related to health, fitness, and longevity.
All right. Well, thank you, and thanks for being on here, and thanks for joining us on Healthy Bloomington with Dr. Andree.